The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Claire Armistead, books editor of The Guardian and Observer. This month's guest is the multi-award-winning Ian McEwan. Amazingly, it was the very first time he's been to talk to us, even though he won his first award way back in 1976 for his short story collection, First Love, Last Rights, and the bestsellers have flowed ever since. He's been listed for the Booker Prize no fewer than six times, winning it in 1998 with his novel Amsterdam. But we've asked him to talk about his latest novel, Sweet Tooth, in which a young university graduate is recruited as a spy in the 1970s. It's a cleverly constructed piece of work, which host John Mullen thought was even better on a second reading. But he asked, do authors consider the second-time reader?
I think all of us novelists live to be read twice. I mean, that's what we most want. And novels are long. And it seems like the world is just unfolding like tarmac coming towards you in a long drive. Second time round, for books you like, those are the real reading pleasures, I think. You start to see how things are put together, how things anticipate one another. In this case, I didn't have clear in my head until about halfway through the precise way in which I was going to deliver what I already knew. I thought maybe I would have Serena separated from her lover and go to visit him when he's an old man. But the thing really structured itself at that point, I mean, given that one is working very, very slowly. And I'd long had this ambition to end a novel in such a way that some story takes place, is implied, and it's not written, that there's something else completely contained within the last few sentences that imply a story, and in this case, it's a 40-year story. The fact that you are reading this last chapter, the fact that Serena therefore implicitly has allowed it to be published and it's therefore in his book, the fact that his book contains things that he could not possibly know, like the IRA, MI5 relationship campaign, all inform us that she has said yes to his marry me and that they've lived together for 40 years.
Yeah. And it also implies something which you take care to dramatise in the course of the novel, that she will help him write.
Yeah.
That she will take part in his fiction.
Yes. Yeah. It's a collaboration. They're going to write this novel together. He's already written it. You're reading a final draft, obviously.
Yes. Everything before this letter, the novel, has actually been written by him. It's really his fiction based on what he's found out about her. Or do I cling on to the thing which I got used to? But it was her. This is her. It's her story, and I've got to know her a bit, and I've got to kind of be intimate with her. And it felt, first time round, as though I wasn't sure I wanted to relinquish that.
Mm. Well, it is essentially him. I mean, I hope that the prose of his letter is just a little different from her voice.
Yeah.
Slightly wider range, maybe slightly pretentious even. Because this is also a novel about reading, and they are two different kinds of readers. They each embody two elements that I hold dear. One is that I think without curiosity in a book, in its opening pages, one is lost. It's very, very hard, unless you're a reviewer, to push yourself through 350 pages. Unless there's some curiosity about something or other. And it could be on any level. I'm not just talking about simple mechanics of plot and what happens. But then there's also the pleasure that Tom takes in a kind of recursiveness and a verbal surface and the range of writers that he adores, she detests. And I thought that Sweet Tooth would be the novel that they would both love. So she insists that there is no good novel unless it ends with a marry me. And he insists that we live in postmodern times and fiction must be aware of its own machinery.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I don't think you can write the self-conscious postmodern recursive fiction unless you have some meat, the kind of meat that Serena loves. And in this case, it is the cultural Cold War, which I think also has elements of this recursiveness. If you think, for example, of the CIA and the vast amount of money it spent from the late 40s onwards, persuading mostly left-of-center European intellectuals that it was not the Soviet Union that was the powerhouse for art, but the West, principally America. So the CIA funded orchestral tours by the Boston Symphony Orchestra, exhibitions of abstract expressionism, a festival, if that's the right word, of atonal music in Paris in 1950. And then, of course, Encounter magazine. Here was a case of the spy agencies, the intelligence agencies, penetrating the life of novelists, artists, composers. Nobody knew that the CIA was paying for this. When I was thinking about this novel before I started writing it, was what would it be like for a spy to go and recruit a novelist to her cause without telling him who she worked for, and at the same time, he is a novelist, a professional spy, if you like, to spy on her. And where would this bond of mutual surveillance take them? Because aren't lovers, when they first meet each other, in a sense, like spies, mutually thinking, well, is he, she the one? There's a mask of outward show, and there's a flurries of joys and doubts and all those things which can't be said early on in a relationship. So I wanted a plot that would give Tom Haley his maximal satisfaction, but it needed to meet all of Serena's needs.
Yeah.
There's an attraction in having a spy deceived by a novelist. After all those years of the Cold War, which were my formative years as a young adult, there's another matter here which fascinates me, which is the way organizations always want to get bigger. And the people who run them can't even tell you why they're embarking on this particular thing. Because the more money you have from the government, the more money you'll get next year. If you don't spend it, some other department will get it. Then you get bigger and bigger and bigger. And so we create institutions that have a life of their own, which no single individual working for them could ever justify. And in fact, the starting point, the Soviet Common Form, which was their arts organization, managed to hold a conference for world peace in New York in 1949. And lots of fellow travelers, and with a very respectable, Lillian Hellman was one, lots of American writers, crowded into the Waldorf Astoria, huge convention hall, 1,000 delegates. Shostakovich was there on Stalin's orders. He dared not go because it would have been a death sentence not to go. There were many American intellectuals and from the West too who felt, well, it's a bit odd, only a few years ago Uncle Joe was our friend and now we're being told that he's a demon. And they weren't fully signed up to, they thought that perhaps the rumors of the gulags were maybe a little overplayed. And then there were upstairs in the hotel, on the 10th floor, in the bridal suite, the most expensive room, about 40 other American intellectuals of the left, the democratic oppositional left to the Soviet Union, who were writing scathing pieces about this conference and how it was duped and it was ridiculous it was happening, but penetrating analyses, and they were devising embarrassing questions to ask Shostakovich when the session came around, and also informing the press. And all the time, the Waldorf were bringing up hamburgers, and it was a great success. The conference failed dismally. The American press were very scathing about it. It turned out that 10th floor suite was funded entirely by the CIA. And the best people to criticize the Soviet Union were ex-communists and democratic socialists. And that really set the tone for years of bad faith, in which people suddenly found that they were flying first class to a nice conference in Berlin to speak about things that really mattered to them, not knowing their tickets were paid. So, yes, an extraordinary period of bad faith. So reading this, I thought, well, wouldn't it be nice for a novelist to have his revenge on this process?
You do it by you have to create a, you talked about Serena's voice, you have to create a narrator who is a woman of her times in a way, and who is quite a kind of free-thinking person in a way, but stands against the temper of her times.
There's this other matter which I'm occasionally taxed with. People say, well, I always thought there was something wrong with Serena. She didn't really sound like a woman to me. And then when I got to the end, I was so pleased. In the first few months when I was talking about this novel, I said nothing. I thought, well, okay, I got away with that then. But in fact, I wonder if there isn't a bit of sexist assumption that you couldn't have a heroine who could solve an abstract problem ahead of her novelist lover. You know, like the Monty Hall problem, for example, which is a, you know, some people get it straight away, that problem of the boxes and the probabilities, and other people can't. Serena can get it, Tom cannot. That she's good at chess and has a sort of skepticism about her. I thought, well, why not? Why? I mean, we have in our family a very good mathematician who happens to be a woman. It's a sort of, and there are many who are. So I've now come around to saying, well, if you thought that she sounded like a man, I failed, because she was meant to sound like a woman.
She tells you things like how much money she gave the man to carry the chair back to her flat. She gave him more than he asked for.
She gives him a 2p tip.
Yes. Yeah.
Cost 13p, I gave him 15p.
Yes. Yeah. So there's a kind of certain sort of fussiness in her, isn't there, about getting these little things right?
This is the problem, because she's got to be a character, but she also has to narrate a novel.
Yeah.
Yes. And she has to withhold information,
yes.
Or he has to withhold it speaking through her. I've always been sceptical of the tendency of more and more novels to be written in the first person. And it's a prejudice, and I can't defend it to the hilt, but I'll just voice it anyway. I often wonder if the first person narration doesn't let you off the hook of the demands of good prose. You can say, well, you know, if my character talks in clichés, what can I do about it? But when you come to write a spy novel, it's much easier to write in the first person, because that person can't know everything. And that's one of the supreme strokes of cleverness in Le Carré, that he writes with an omniscient narrative and yet still withholds all the information. It's a wonderful trick he does. But it's very, very tempting move into the first person. So I had to let Serena be herself, but I also wanted her to notice the things that I notice. And if she's being dumped, well, why not have, as she says, you know, I felt dumped like the buns.
And it's clear, and they say you read novel, and it's clear none of them has ever read a novel.
It's amazing. You can get through life and be a sentient being without reading a novel. It's the case.
And one of them says, doesn't he, of course it's very, very difficult to tell what a writer, what a person thinks from reading a novel by them. As this is a kind of little bit of a puzzle which might eventually be cracked.
Well, that's why you need to choose a novelist who writes journalism, where they give it all away. Don't we constantly meet people who never read novels? I mean, it's, and they seem perfectly all right to me. You know, not complete idiots, get their information about the world in other ways.
Tom, late on in the novel, although he's talking about short stories rather than novels, his own short stories, and he explains to Serena, doesn't he, that in some way, if you're ingenious enough and if you know enough, the opposite of what the MI5 chap said is true, that all these stories she's read were all stories about him, actually, and his novelistic ambitions.
But they also reflect on her fate, too.
Yes.
So there's all that. I must just tell you something about Tom Haley, an academic working at Sussex, an expert on Spencer, is that when I handed in the draft to Random House, he was called Tom Healy. And
head
just
department,
before,
yeah.
And so that we'd gone through all the editing process, and just about the presses were about to roll for the hardback, and someone discovered that there was an academic at Sussex University, specialist in Spencer, called Tom Healy.
Yeah.
And I said, no, I'll just change it, because I knew it was exam time, it was early June. He might be away, he might take weeks to read it, he might not be someone, if he's interested in Spencer, read novels, if all I knew. So I changed it to Healy. And then the following week, I went down to Sussex University because I was being awarded a prize, a medal. It was the 50th anniversary of Sussex University last year. And who was doing the award? Tom Healy. And I broke the news. I said, I can't believe it. He was going to give a little speech. And when I told him, he said, oh, I would have loved to have been here. But it was too late.
Oh, well. Well, maybe I could ask you about real people, actually, because the real people... it's a nice irony, because, of course, the novel does have real people in. And... you're not the first novelist to have real people in their novels, but the real people here are real people who aren't just in the background, you know, people like William Golding or whoever, but they're people we meet, people who come, and people whom you've known. So there's Ian Hamilton with his glass of wine in the pub in Soho, and we meet him, and he speaks, and he plays a certain part in the story. And your own publisher, Tom Mashler, he's in the book. That, you know, obviously, lots of people remarked upon this.
I know, some people were very annoyed.
Well, they were.
They were really cross, and I even thought rather feebly, oh, well, you know, when the paperback comes out, I'll just change Ian Hamilton's name to Alex Muir. And,
why do you think people were cross about it?
It seems kind of like some in-joke or, I don't know, something like that. But I thought, well, when I was... I mean, the principal character who really is given flesh and bone is Ian Hamilton. And I did think of just giving him some other name. Then I thought, no, but wait a minute, it's him. So why not call it him? And it is the Pillar of Hercules. It is the New Review. It was an important little... place where writers used to hang out in the early to mid-70s. It was of no interest to anyone at the time. We were all right at the beginning of our careers. It was a time when actually what novelists did was of no interest to newspapers. So, I mean, it was a completely different sort of world. Also, it's an old trick of narrative realism to mingle your fictional ghosts with real people, so that's always... It makes the fictional people seem a little more plausible or a little more enmeshed in a real world that we all share and know. But at the same time, it's not essential. So, I mean, I got into no trouble about this in Holland and Portugal because no one had heard of Tom Mashler or Ian Hamilton. So I was fine. I was scot-free.
What about Millie Trimmingham? She's the...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. She was the... she's the interstitial one, isn't she? Because she's both a recognisable person but not named as such.
Yes, well, I mean, Stella Rimington has a ghostwriter. And I think that's a sort of useful kind of shadow element of this. And it could be Millie Trimmingham. There was a women's revolt in MI5 in November 1972. Because of this glass ceiling, which was extremely low, women weren't allowed in MI5 to run agents. It was amazing. I mean, given the number of Burgess, MacLean, Philby, Cairncross, it was felt that women couldn't keep a secret. and it was generally that felt that. It was extraordinary. And Stella Rimmington was the one who broke through. She doesn't write about it in her memoir, but in the unofficial history of MI5, there's an account of what's called the Women's Revolt, capitalized. high-flying graduate women, mostly from Oxford and Cambridge, some from UCL, I expect, started meeting on, and it was, I guess, at the same time of that second wave of feminism that was gathering strength in the early 70s, to organise themselves and start to protest about the fact that they couldn't get below clerical officer grade 2, whatever their qualifications were, however good their degree. And what amazed me was that all their meetings were bugged by their male colleagues and superiors. And I was hoping to find a way of fitting this into the novel, and then I wrote a chunk of it, but it just... I thought, well, no, the forward motion of this, I have to abandon this. But I always feel this tinge of regret.
I wanted just the last question to ask you about the very beginning, actually, the epigraph. It's from Timothy Garton Ash's book, The File. And it says, "If only I had met, on this search, a single clearly evil person."
Well, first of all, to tell you about The File, Tim Garton Ash was in Berlin as a journalist in the late 70s, and he constantly crossed into East Berlin, made many, many close friends, had love affairs. When the wall came down many years later, he decided to go and look in his Stasi files. And the book, The File, which I recommend strongly, is about him discovering the number of people who informed on him to the Stasi. And so in the book, he goes around confronting these people, not in a massively hostile way. He just wants to know the circumstances by which, you know, their love affair or all the dinners and so on were, why the informant needed to do this. And the stories can be very touching. You know, we needed to keep our child at university. We were told, you know, he'd lose his place, or we wouldn't, you know, my husband would lose his job, and we never told them anything significant, so on. And so he goes through all these years, some of it a surprise to him, because so much he'd forgotten. And at the end of it, he works all his way up to the head, this man called Wolf, and goes to see him in a little suburban bungalow in Berlin. And this, to come back to what I said earlier about organizations, an organization can be doing something incredibly destructive without anyone in it being anything other than rather ordinary. And that's what I was trying to get at here. In Serena's movement through MI5, she meets no evil people. And yet the whole thing stinks. I mean, and rots like a sweet tooth. It involves an extraordinary amount of bad faith. So it's that, the curious disjunction between ordinary people working within organisations that have a life of their own and do socially destructive things.
It's time I gave everybody else a chance.
Thanks. I just had two questions, if I may. The first is, how did you find Serena's voice, and at what point did you decide to use the device of it actually not being her voice? And the second was that you mentioned writing, you know, that wonderful scene of all the women meeting to discuss their revolution and it being bugged and then discarding it. And I wondered how much you wrote that you then discarded, and a bit about your process in that respect.
I blunder my way into novels, and so the first bit of continuous prose I wrote of Sweet Tooth was a couple of paragraphs of Serena dressed up in her best clothes, striding rather disdainfully through Sussex students on her way to... And they're all bare feet, and the girls have got no makeup and plain straight hair and tie-dye skirts. And she thinks the boys all look ridiculous. And that was when I knew that I now had a novel to write. And just as Tom describes himself as rather status-hungry, obsessive, materialistic, I wanted Serena to reveal herself, rather conventional, desperate for the praise of authority figures, never gets her sister Lucy, you know, the dropout who's found with cannabis in detection-proof plastic at Dover Customs. All those were in those first few lines, and at that point I knew I could begin. But it took me a year to get back to that point.
And what about
what was the other question?
The rebellious MI5.
Oh, I just wrote extensive notes. I didn't write any continuous proper narrative prose. But I had notes on it, and I thought, actually, this could be a whole other novel.
I'd like to ask you about the short stories in the novel.
Yeah.
Did you write those short stories deliberately for this novel? Or were they stories that you'd stored away? You know, here was one I prepared earlier, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And thought, oh, that would be quite good to put in for Tom's other work.
Well, two or three of them I had written and published. There's a story about a guy who falls in love with a shop window dummy and takes it home and then begins to get jealous of her because he thinks she's having an affair with his chauffeur, who's a very rich man. And I used that, but changed it. And there were one or two other stories that I... It was partly to do with revisiting the 70s. I thought it would help me just to go back into my own stories. And then I invented two or three other stories. The story about the vicar and his brother and giving the sermon comes from an abandoned novel. About 4 years ago, I was going to write a novel about a man, an atheist, whose brother is a vicar, and the vicar falls ill, and the atheist goes to deliver the sermon for him and does a very good job of mimicry and begins to get a taste for it. Not for God, but for giving sermons. And I thought, actually, I'm not sure this is enough to sustain a novel. So I hauled that one off the back burner. And then the story about the man who discovers that his wife has staged a burglary in his house and the police then tell him that they have on film his wife coming to sell all that stuff. That was invented purely for the novel. I spent a lot of time trying to work out the best way of having Serena read these stories and us read them too. And for a good while I thought, why not just put the stories in? But it just interrupted the flow of things too much. I ended up devising a convention of summary with italicized quotes in order to get us through at a fair lick.
I was curious to know what you would think that the person to whom you dedicated the novel would think of it.
I hoped he would love it. This is Christopher Hitchens. I mentioned it to him, what I was doing, and he instantly, as he has on many occasions, gave me a reading list off the top of his head. Quite extraordinary, out-of-the-way sources of stuff. I think the last novel Hitch read was Wolf Hall, which he really adored.
Yeah.
Although gender might not have been at the forefront of your mind when you were writing this novel, I think it's important when you're writing, when you talked about it, and Tom had to kind of get into the skin of Serena, and you talk about him holding her handbag and getting into her skirts or whatever.
Yeah.
So I was wondering how you responded to people who might accuse you of subjugating the female voice and identity, you know, for the man. So do you see this as a gender problem or not?
No, I think of it as a narrative problem, but not a gender problem, because I don't see where the subjugation would come in. I could have made Serena a man and, you know, Tom a woman.
But the gender was obviously crucial to you, because you said that Tom had to get into Serena's gender through her clothing and such.
Absolutely, as indeed did I. That's what novelists have to do, whether they're getting into the trousers or skirts of whoever. They have to invade them. That's what we all do, I think, in all social intercourse. Empathize with others and imagine what it's like to be them in order to guess their intentions and meanings. And I think the novel is a refinement, truly a refinement of that process of something we do instinctively, and has brought it, you know, over since the middle of the 18th century to, I think, a high form. But I don't think there's any element of subjugation in that.
I'm just wondering, when you are planning a novel and when you are writing a novel, how much of the narrative do you know and have pre-plotted and pre-planned, and how much just happens as you go along?
I had a strong sense of what I wanted, but I didn't know how I was going to achieve it. And writing a novel is really a discovery of the narrowing of your options. You know, as you go in further, then obviously fewer and fewer things are possible, if you want consistency, that is. Broadly, I know what I want. I did have a vague idea that I would catch up with Serena as an old woman, but there I thought, no, that is getting really too much like Atonement. But that became irrelevant once I got halfway through and I could see that the mechanisms by which Serena was going to be exposed was through a colleague who was jealous, and the last thing I wanted was to jump out of the time frame. So it's a matter of having a sketch rather than anything too defined. Not thinking about them too much till you get there.
Do you find you surprise yourself?
Yes, I mean, surprise is one of the loveliest things about sitting around writing novels, is the hope that you're going to surprise yourself, give yourself an extra opportunity, have even an adjective-noun coupling that gives you just a pleasure of surprise. There's something curious about thinking or writing. You can never quite choose what to think about. I mean, you can sometimes make yourself sit down and think about a problem, but it's very hard to do it over an extended period of time without something else drifting in. And things drift in with, if you have to write a novel over 2.5 years, which you could never guess in advance. And so you get to the point, say, two-thirds of the way through a book, you're writing a page which, if you were suddenly plonked down in it, as it were, from your past, you would be amazed. Who are these people? What are this situation? What are they about?
About 15 years ago, I was at university and I wrote a dissertation on Ian McEwan, you, and voyeurism, which, to be honest, entailed some quite dodgy reading.
You mean reading of people, not me?
Well, yes. And I noticed that you had a kind of, in many of your books and short stories, a very cool, cool, detached, observant narrator, where you kind of observe quite intimate details, but in a quite detached way. For example, in The Comfort of Strangers, when you're inside the hotel room at the beginning, when there's two sort of unnamed sleeping bodies, but yes, all the shutters are down and you're kind of looking, yeah, as an outsider but being very intimate. Is this a method that you kind of deliberately developed, or is it something that kind of came naturally?
Well, I could hide behind assertions like all novelists are voyeurs. It has to be something to do with what I like in reading as well as what I like in writing. In other words, I love writing that makes me see the scene with clarity, and I love precision. One of the writers I admire a great deal is Conrad. And Conrad, as you know, wrote that famous preface to The Nigger of Narcissus, that his task was to make you see. And that requires you to find, since you can't describe everything in a room, in a hotel room, is to find the detail and hone in on it and hope that it carries also some little penumbra of emotional weight that will serve your purpose. To see clearly is also somewhat of a detaching process. But there are other occasions, you know, I would want readers to think that, you know, the whole stretches of, I don't know, any book, Atonement, for example, that have none of that detachment, and that the prose pursues the idea that words, sentences, should be like glass, that you see straight through them. You don't even notice the sentence. You see the thing that the sentence refers to, which is another kind of state of grace, I think. Glass prose. These are the two elements that I think one moves backwards and forwards between. But detail noticing, what Nabokov called fondling the details in a lecture he gave to Cornell students. All readers, he was talking to English 101 students. But I take his advice to heart as a writer as well as a reader. Forget the moonshine of generalizations. You know nothing about literature, he says to these young students. Do not talk to me of themes. I don't want to hear you talk about themes. You're not grown up enough to talk about themes. Your business is to fondle the details as a reader. And I take that advice to heart. But I fondle them warmly.
Well, Nabokov also said something like, something very encouraging to academic critics, but which I think is true also of what Ian's talked about this evening. He said that if you understand the machinery of a novel, it gives you more pleasure, not less. Thanks to you all very much for coming and for your questions, for your swatting. Thank you very much, and I'm sure that you'd all want me to thank him very much. Thank you.
Go to guardian.co.uk/audio.